This is The Guardian.
Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab einem Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.
This is the nation of Babbage, of Lovelace, of Turing, that gave birth to the modern computer. So mark my words, Britain will be one of the great AI superpowers.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is facing renewed scrutiny of her economic plans after the value of the pound fell and the cost of UK government borrowing rose again.
When we won the general election, we won it as a team and we govern as a team in Rachel's got the support of me, the Prime Minister, and the whole Cabinet.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. Well, here we are at Westminster once again on a Monday afternoon this time. We'll come to the reasons for that later. But Kieran, are you sort of raring to go? You had a good weekend?
Yeah, lovely weekend. The next step in my attempts to indoctrinate my children in the cult of being Crystal Palace fans was this weekend. So I took my kids to the third round of the FA Cup and my 7-year-old son was very, very excited by our 1-0 win. My 4-year-old daughter was a little less so, I will admit, not least because it was so cold. So by about the 17th minute I had, can we go home, Daddy? And I had to explain, we do not leave games early.
That's a bit hard. That's hardcore for 4 years old.
That is a family rule.
I also had a weekend surrounded by children. In fact, I think at one point I counted 13 children in my house, including 3 of my own, just because we didn't really have very many plans. So I said yes to everything that the kids wanted to do. So we had sleepovers.
We had
teenagers gathering and not wanting anyone else in the kitchen at the same time as them. We had all sorts. A massive game of hide and seek yesterday. And I appear to have done my back in, and I reckon it's because it's not the hide and seek. It's obviously too old for that. I reckon it's because the amount of food we were producing, I was like bending down to put stuff in the dishwasher, you know, get stuff out the oven the whole weekend.
Children are so bad for your back, but you are bravely sitting in the tightest, smallest corner in all of Westminster, in our cupboard, here to podcast for everybody today. So, you know, good on you for turning up.
Yes, absolutely. But the backdrop to all of this, of course, is that things aren't looking very good for the government, at least on an economic front this morning, and specifically for Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor. We've had a big drop in the value of the pound over the last few days, and again this morning, plus a bond market sell-off, which has left the UK economy on pretty shaky ground. And well, of course, we know that the UK is far from the only world economy struggling currently against headwinds. The current economic challenges could spell big problems for the government. There's been a lot of comparisons in the last few days, Kieran, with the Liz Truss mini budget. And yet people I speak to inside government are pretty philosophical about it all. They say, as Keir Starmer said in a speech this morning as well, that this is, you know, to be expected, that they have talked a lot about the difficult economic inheritance, and the reality is just this, the sort of, you know, difficulties with boosting growth, you know, fears over stagflation, so no growth and also inflation too, and not enough interest rate cuts and all that sort of thing. Was this to be expected? Is it as bad as Liz Truss?
Well, those are two different questions. Is it as bad as Liz Truss? Clearly not. I mean, there hasn't been a dramatic jump up in the borrowing rates, you know, in the immediate aftermath of a fiscal announcement like there was with the Liz Truss mini budget, which then had to be completely unpicked to get the markets back to normal. This has been much more gradual. But in a way, it's more difficult to deal with because of that. There's not obviously one measure that can then be unpicked to get things back on track. But I would point out that the amount that the British government pays to borrow money over a 10-year period is now more than they were paying in the aftermath of the Liz Truss budget. So the 10-year gilt yield is now higher, I think, than at any point in the last 30 years. I mean, it is pretty severe economic news coming from the markets. Was it to be expected? Absolutely not. Anybody who says, as Keir Starmer was saying this morning, we'll come on to this, but as Keir Starmer was saying, we always knew we were going to face a difficult economic inheritance, and this is just part of dealing with that. No, I mean, Labour people thought this was a particularly good election to win because it looked like it was just the start of some kind of economic recovery. They thought that they would have money to play with. And one of the reasons I think that Rachel Reeves gave herself so little wiggle room in the last budget was because they thought they were soon going to have the proceeds of growth to be able to spend.
Yep.
Instead, we've got negative GDP. We've got borrowing costs that have gone up so high that we're now talking about another round of spending cuts to make. This is not the inheritance that they thought they were getting and not what they were planning to do.
Yeah, and just on that, I mean, Rachel Reeves thought at the last budget that she'd have about £10 billion of fiscal headroom and against that goal of balancing books by the end of the Parliament. But what she and what Keir Starmer made absolutely clear is that their so-called fiscal rules are non-negotiable. They've said that they don't want to have further tax rises after the budget where we had 50 billion quid's worth of them. They said they're not going to borrow anymore. So what does that leave? That leaves, as you say, spending cuts. And I think a big concern amongst ministers at the moment is where they will fall, because we have what we called like protected departments. The NHS is the obvious one. It received about 22 billion quid at the last budget. It's expecting extra. Yes, of course, extra. And they're expecting, it's expecting more this time round. We're also expecting an uplift in funding for the Ministry of Defence, given the backdrop of the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and the fact that there's a lot of uncertainty around what the US will do when Donald Trump comes in next week, can you imagine it? But that there will also be attached to that will be how that money is spent. And that leaves less and less money available for other departments when you consider that things like schools and international aid will be amongst things that will be protected. The axe is going to fall pretty heavily on areas like local councils again, potentially transport again. And we asked, Keir Starmer was asked about this morning at this event, and he said, yeah, we're going to be ruthless.
Ruthless was the language, was the word he used. Although it was interesting because I was at that event and journalist after journalist stood up and asked specifically the question, should we expect spending cuts to come? And he just wouldn't answer the question. And I think journalists were getting quite frustrated by the end of this because the Treasury has been answering the question. And in fact, I spoke to a Treasury source last week and I said, look, you're essentially, the market moves have left you with one of three choices. You can either break your fiscal rules and borrow more, you can tax more, or you can spend less. What are you going to do? And they were very clear, we're going to spend less. That's the choice that we're making. But he didn't quite lean into that argument. He didn't say so explicitly. But yes, I mean, the OBR forecast from the last budget show that after 2026, unprotected departments, like you say, those are things like local government, justice, transport, the Home Office, are supposed to face cuts of 1.3% per year, every year. Now, we already know how stretched the public services are. We were told this government was coming in to kind of restore them to a certain extent. Now they're talking about making heavier cuts. And they insist to us, and I know they've been saying this to you a lot recently, Pippa, but they said this is not austerity.
Mm.
Well, fine, but it's going to feel like it. And especially if those cuts have to be much more severe than what they're planning because of the market, then people are going to feel it.
And one department which comes up again and again when you ask people inside government about where those cuts are going to fall is, of course, the Department for Work and Pensions. And the suggestion in particular that the government's planning billions of pounds worth of cuts to particularly disability benefits to try and calm the markets. And that includes to a disability benefit called personal independence payments, which are commonly known as PIP. And, you know, the backdrop to this is that the annual cost of support payments for people with disabilities and various health conditions is going to soar, is forecast to soar from 22 billion to 35 billion by 2029. That's a 60% increase. Now, those are big numbers. And, the government says the numbers of people that are claiming them has absolutely surged. As we've seen and we've talked about before, mental health issues are amongst those which have grown significantly, including, of course, over the pandemic. And Rishi Sunak looked at reforming the PIP system, but it's very difficult to do politically, even if you using the state of the economy as justification. And disability groups in particular, and Labour MPs, many Labour MPs, will be very anxious about the idea that the government will target this particular area in order to try and save some money.
We were surprised, weren't we, when Liz Kendall stood up and presented her kind of plan to get people back to work, that she didn't actually start talking about PIPs and doing anything more drastic on universal credit as well. We thought there might be cuts there. I think it was felt at the time that having cut winter fuel payments quite so severely, this would be a very difficult thing to kind of come back and do so again, but on a different part of the welfare budget. However, Liz Kendall does have a green paper, which is supposed to be coming out in the spring, about benefit reform. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if some of these moves were in there. In fact, what I'm told is there will be a green paper in very early spring. Mm-hmm. So I suspect that means before the Chancellor stands up and announces the latest OBR forecasts at the end of March. And I'm told it will be wide ranging, likely to cover both not just PIP, but also the health related elements of the universal credit. So there have already been some changes on how the work capability mm-hmm. assessment is carried out. I'm told that Labour might go further still on that. It does feel like everything's converging on welfare cuts as the way out of this hole, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it's not just cuts to the public services, which people will be feeling. It will also be in their own pocket as a result of the economic picture. The Bank of England, which was expected just a few months ago to make as many as 4 interest rate cuts in 2025, is significantly less likely to do that now. We might even see just 1. And there's almost 2 million people in the UK who are due to come off fixed rate mortgages this year, which means that inevitably they will be paying more for their mortgage. And that's a very direct impact in people's pockets of what's going on in the markets. You mentioned anemic growth earlier, Kieran. Well, the government still seems to be pushing towards boosting growth as a way out of this economic situation. That isn't going to be easy. She's asked, as we reported just before Christmas, every minister that comes up with any sort of policy proposal going forward is going to have to prove that it's a growth benefit, or at the very least growth neutral, and certainly isn't going to dampen growth in any way. So it's going to be that test before any policies get signed off. This week, she's calling in various regulators, urging them to embrace risk. I mean, they're kind of defined by taking a cautious approach, these organisations, aren't they? They're things like the Competition and Markets Authority, Ofcom, the Environment Agency, the Financial Conduct Authority. She's going to see 16 of them over the next fortnight. And of course, she's just got back from a trip to China, which she was there over the weekend. And despite calls from opposition parties for her not to go, which I think actually would have been a really bad move to cancel the trip, particularly given Beijing's attachment to protocol. But the sort of the underlying drive behind that trip was to go and try and boost trading relationships, particularly given there's the uncertainty of the US-China relationship under Trump, and to try and sort of, get some growth from wherever they can.
Yeah, I mean, not only Beijing's attachment to protocol, but I think that cancelling that trip could easily have actually spooked the markets further. I mean, there's no way to signal that you're panicking like cancelling a major growth-oriented trip. I think that would have been very, very damaging.
And there's historical precedence, isn't there? It was a Jim Callaghan flying back from, during the winter of discontent, flying back from the Caribbean, and the Sun's headline the next day was crisis. What crisis? Now, Callaghan obviously didn't actually say those words, but they hung around his neck for decades.
Yeah, exactly. It was interesting as well this morning being at Keir Starmer's speech, and we'll come to what he was actually supposed to be talking about in a bit, but a lot of the questions were asked were focused on Rachel Reeves herself and whether she was safe in the job until the next election. My view on this is he is so completely linked to her and his project is so intrinsically linked to what she is doing at the Treasury that there is no way he can sack her without it completely backfiring on himself. You know, if Keir Starmer takes out the Chancellor who's supposed to be overseeing this recovery, that essentially says they got their economic plan completely wrong. So I really don't think that's going to happen. In fact, if anything, this gives her more power, because if everything that the government is trying to do is about the economy, then she becomes even more powerful than she already is. And it was described to me by one slightly mischievous government advisor recently that, of course, Rachel Reeves is the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer's just the Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because, of course, Keir Starmer's, I mean, I can't even, I've lost count of the amount of trips he's been on representing Britain right across the world, but he seems to spend as much time out of the country as in it at the moment. But absolutely agree with you, Kieran, that it would be a sign of incredible weakness for Rachel Reeves to be moved on from this role anytime soon, or indeed probably before the next election, because it very much was a joint project. Her success is intrinsically linked to the government's success and also Keir Starmer's success. And I think you're as likely to see the whole project go down the Swanee as you are to see Reeves leave the Treasury.
Yeah.
And the other thing to say is that Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves remain close. I was speaking to someone inside government the other day that says that Rachel Reeves spends pretty much every morning in her office in number 11 Downing Street, which listeners may not know is actually connected, not even by doors, just by corridors with number 10. And you can wander back and forth between them. She's there every morning at the early meetings. She speaks to Keir Starmer throughout the day and to Morgan McSweeney, his chief of staff. Her team are very plugged in Downing Street. I mean, there are tensions in government, let's not kid ourselves, but they don't seem to be between Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, who seem pretty joined at the hip when it comes to their approach to how the government should be dealing with the economic pressures.
Yeah, it feels to me this is probably the closest PM-Chancellor relationship we've had. I mean, maybe you could say Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng, but of course that collapsed. But really since David Cameron and George Osborne.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I said earlier, I've just got back now from Keir Starmer's big AI speech, and he was asked repeatedly about Rachel Reeves, and he did say, you know, I've got full confidence in her. She's right to be ruthless, and absolutely, you know, gave her his full backing. And talking about the economy, I mean, that speech, I have to say, it was really eye-opening for me. Keir Starmer stood up this morning and basically told us at length what a wonderful thing AI is going to be. Mm. As he was speaking, I had my phone in my hand, because I was sure that I'd heard fairly different things from Labour about a year and a half ago at the time of the Bletchley Park AI Summit, which was Rishi Sunak's big project. And I was right. I did remember this correctly. After the Bletchley Park Summit, Peter Kyle, who is now the Science and Innovation Secretary, talked about having a small number of companies that could do serious damage, spreading misinformation around the country, taking jobs away from people, and how this sector really needed regulation. Well, Keir Starmer today basically said, no, that's not the approach we're going to take. We're going to go full guns blazing. We're going to hand over government data to AI companies to go over. We're going to try and make the BBC content available. We're going to make the National Archives and the National Museum material available for AI researchers. This is, and all of this comes back to, the reason I bring it up in the context of the economy, it felt like this was somebody desperately searching for ways out of the economic trap that he's found himself in. But it was really surprising to hear the tone that he used this morning.
He also, standing up there, and I wasn't at the speech in Stratford in East London, but was watching off the telly in our office in the Commons. Something one minister said to me last week when we were talking about AI and sort of the relationship with big tech was that Keir Starmer doesn't really seem much like a digital age politician. Mm. He's much more of a, as they put it, an analog age politician. And actually, even if you compare him to some other leading politicians, Kemi Badenoch not being the obvious one, she has, for better or for worse, some in her party would say for worse, a real online presence, spends a lot of her time online. She's a computer software engineer by training. You know, she has that backdrop. And Keir Starmer just doesn't. And also for him to sort of have gone from opposition to government, from erring towards caution when it came to big tech, it felt like, as you say, and now sort of embracing it full guns blazing. And there'll be lots of people who'd be quite uncomfortable about one particular aspect of it, which I want to pick up with you, which is his suggestions that all of our health data, our NHS data, could be opened up to big tech companies in an effort, you know, as part of this big sort of AI revolution. And the suggestion that he made is that the health service could make its archives of scans, of biodata, of anonymised patient records available for the first time to train AI models. Now, there'll be all sorts of safeguards in place to make sure that the NHS and the British government retains control ultimately over what they access and how much they access. But I have to say, there'll be a lot of people feeling a bit anxious about that.
Yeah, let me read you his words, because it was very striking. He was asked, will people's NHS data be up for grabs here? And I was certainly expecting a kind of nuanced response that said, well, you know, we have to tread very carefully here, and people's right to privacy needs to be respected, and this is our great NHS, and we need to make sure that we don't just turn it over to the private sector. This is what he said.
We are in a unique position in this country because we've got the National Health Service. And the use of that data has already driven forward advances in medicine and will continue to do so. So we have to see this as a huge opportunity that will impact on the lives of millions of people. It is important that we keep control of that data. I completely accept that challenge, and we will also do so. But I don't think that we should have a defensive stance here that will inhibit the sort of breakthroughs that we need.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was, you know, really, really gung-ho from a prime minister I normally think of as cautious on almost everything.
So I think he's being encouraged in it by Peter Carl, who you mentioned, but also Wes Streeting, the health secretary. I was in Department for Health last week interviewing Wes Streeting, and we were talking about, amongst other things, the power of big tech, and that included sort of big social media firms, platforms like X. Obviously, the government's had this ongoing battle with, or rather been on the receiving end of some tirades from Elon Musk in recent weeks, but also, you know, sort of the tech industry more broadly. And he was suggesting to me that he thinks that there's going to be a major struggle ahead for the future of technology. And that, you know, as with any revolution, the key thing for him and for the government is that it has to be in the hands of the many, so to speak, mm-hmm. rather than the privileged few. So rather than the tech billionaires pulling all the strings, it has to be put for the common good and governed by democratic principles. His exact words were, there's going to be a big global battle over this over the course of the century as to whether it's democracy or tyranny that triumphs in this space. And I thought that was really powerful, actually, that you know, they are thinking about this in government. Whether some of their actions make it more likely for one side or the other to win out, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, this is like sort of long-term realignment, really, of where power lies that governments everywhere are having to deal with.
Yeah, and I think that the slight utopian nature of that quote that you just read out belies the complexity of this, which is that it's a very expensive thing to do to develop your own AI models. I mean, it costs a huge amount in computing power and energy. And I know that the government is now planning to build some of their own data centers and their own computing power. But really, I think this will continue to be something that's led by the private sector. Now, if that's the case, they need a financial incentive to work in this area. People are going to want to monetize that NHS data. Yeah. Let's not pretend that there's any way out of that. And that does mean essentially that there will be companies that will be extremely powerful. And I don't think there's any kind of, you know, way that the government can just fudge their way out of that one. So yeah. You mentioned Peter Carl and Wes Streeting, by the way. One other person that I think listeners should keep their eye on as far as the government's AI policy is a man called Matt Clifford. Now, he's not very well known, but he essentially got the ear of Rishi Sunak and helped him run. In fact, he did personally, but he's a former investor in tech, and he basically ran the AI safety summit at Bletchley Park. He's obviously got very close to Keir Starmer because he was sitting next to him on the front row at the Stratford speech today, and in fact introduced him onto the stage. Matt Clifford, I think, is going to be a very influential person when it comes to government tech and AI policy. And I think it's definitely worth watching what he says on things.
Well, he drew up a list of 50 recommendations, all of which I gather Keir Starmer has...
He says he's going to implement them all.
Said he's going to implement. But yep. Kieran, you're going to have a busy day on the podcast front, aren't you? Because later on, you're going to be focusing on another story for our sister podcast, Today in Focus. Another issue potentially problem that has been brewing for the government over the last week to do with the anti-corruption minister, Tulip Sadiq. Tell us briefly what's going on there and how much of a headache this actually is for Labour.
Yeah, I mean, the question is really whether Tulip Sadiq becomes the second ministerial casualty of this Labour government. She is the city minister. She also has responsibility, rather unfortunately, as far as this story is concerned, for anti-corruption, the government's anti-corruption policies. She is also the niece of a woman called Sheikh Hasina, who until last summer was the quite authoritarian ruler, prime minister in Bangladesh, had overseen several elections which were uncontested because she essentially had put so many of the opposition party members in jail that they boycotted the elections. The reason that Sheikh Hasina had to leave government was because there were student protests that just took over Dhaka. And for several days, there was a very, very brutal police response to those protests, and around 1,000 people died. And we're going to be reporting more about exactly what that police response was like in the coming days. Now, Tulip Sadiq has always insisted that she had very little to do with her aunt. And when she saw her, she didn't speak about politics. But I think we're starting to discover quite how politically they linked they were as well, not least because Tulip and her immediate family seem to have lived in at least 5 properties that were paid for by people connected at quite a senior level to Sheikh Hasina's party and government. So it's something I think that, you know, we might find out in the next week or two, really, what the fate of the city minister is going to be.
And this is being obviously being looked at by the Prime Minister's ethics advisor, Sir Laurie Magnus, who will decide whether Tulip Sadiq has breached the ministerial code, particularly in relation to those properties. As one of her colleagues said to me a couple of days ago, that even if she has stuck to the letter of the ministerial code, there's already a feeling that she may not have stuck to the spirit of it. And as they said, it doesn't pass the smell test. Well, we'll have to see what Laurie Magnus's ruling is, of course, on that, and ultimately Keir Starmer's decision. But before we go today, we've got some good news, Kieran. We've been nominated for 2 in-house political podcast awards.
Hooray!
Politics Weekly Westminster, we're delighted to say, is up for Best Newcomer. And also, you, Kieran, are nominated for Best Rising Star.
Wow, what an honour. And that means that Politics Weekly Westminster and Politics Weekly UK are up for the People's Choice Awards, which you can vote for if you enjoy this podcast. And even if you don't, please vote for us anyway. It doesn't matter. The deadline is Tuesday, the 21st of January. And you can vote for us and John Harris at politicalpodcastawards.co.uk/the-people's-choice-award. But the main thing, politicalpodcastawards.co.uk. Vote early. You can't vote often. I've already tried to vote often, but they stop you from doing it.
Get your family to vote. If every household, 5 people need to vote.
Absolutely. Get voting.
And we'll put that link in the show notes for this episode as well. If you've enjoyed this episode or our many others, we would really appreciate your vote. And also, please don't forget to like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. John Harris is back with another episode on Thursday. This episode was produced by Frankie Toby, music by Axel Cucoutier, and the executive producer is Zoe Hitch. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian. Du träumst davon, dem Alltag zu entfliehen oder die Welt zu bereisen? Das bedeutet wahrscheinlich, dass du dir ein unabhängiges Leben wünschst. Investieren für deine Zukunft kann dir dabei helfen. Mit iShares ETFs kann jeder anfangen, kleine, regelmäßige Beträge zu investieren. Und das schon ab 1 Euro. So kannst du deine Zukunftsziele erreichen, ohne einen Berg von Papierkram zu bewältigen. Mehr Zeit zum Träumen. Finde iShares bei deinem Broker oder deiner Bank und fange noch heute an, mit ETFs zu sparen. Kapitalanlagerisiko. Marketinginformation.